Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to Nishit Desai Associates Roundtable and Webinar on Mitigating Indemnity Risk in PE M&A Deals in India. We have with us today Angus Marshall, AIG M&A Insurance Group, Mark Story, AIG M&A Insurance Group, Mandira Gupta, Marsh India, Nishal Joshipura, Nishit Desai Associates, Simon Rees, Nishit Desai Associates, Karan Kalra, Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. In case you need assistance during the conference call, please signal for an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Karan Kalra from Nishit Desai Associates. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Hey, I'd like to start by, of course, thanking all of you who are here with us in person and on phone, and welcoming each of you to this webinar. We'll, you know, it's a technical topic, but we'll try and make it as interesting as it can be for all of you. The Indian private equity and M&A scene has been, you know, to say the least, very exciting over the last few years. And not just that, it's developing from a very, very nascent market. It's developing into being a more advanced, a more robust market with more nuances coming in, right? So the first thing that's important for all of us is to kind of concentrate and understand properly what the key issues in this space are, right? And right at the center, right at the core of these core issues is this whole conundrum of representations, warranties, indemnities, and, you know, how do they work? What are the protections around it? Now, what's very interesting to understand is it's not plain vanilla, right? All of us understand, okay, a representation is a statement of fact and you write it and you're done with it, right? Or an indemnity is some sort of protection around it, like what if it's false tomorrow? But really, there's so many nuances of this and it differs from case to case. When you have private equity players giving representations and warranties and indemnities, it's a very, very different environment as against when you have an individual promoter giving this protection or when you have a strategic player giving this. It's even different within the private equity space. There could be a controlled investor or a majority investor and how they look at it as against, you know, cases where they're minority investors. So this entire space is extremely wide. It's almost confusing at times. It's, I think, very, very important for all of us to give some of these specifics some attention, understand what it is and how they're different, and of course concentrate on what are the key ways to protect around you, right? So with this backdrop, I thought I'd just kind of give you an overview of what we're trying to cover today. We did also mail this out to you in the outlay for today. But the idea is to really cover what is the prevailing environment for representations and warranties in these different circumstances. Who's giving the warranty? At what time is it given? What purpose is it? Is it a primary deal? Is it a secondary deal? A buyout? An M&A? That's one. The other thing we want to share with you is some experiences of as to what are the key challenges we've seen in actually addressing these, right? I'm sure a lot of them come to your mind and we'll talk more about it. We have quite an adept audience in here and hopefully a very, very sorted, you know, panel to tell you about those. Also, a couple of other things that come out that's most important, and we take the second half of the webinar concentrating on insurance. What is this reps and warranty insurance? What is the tax insurance? How does it play out? And how is it important? Who does it help? Who can avail of it? And of course, the various nuances, and I know another topic that you're all waiting for, how are they priced and how they really work out. We talk about that as well. So with that, you know, you've already heard who our panel is, so I won't get into naming them. And if it's good with everyone, I'll kind of start right in with our first topic on representations and warranties and insurances. What are these and how do they work, right? So right up front, maybe I'll start with Simon. And Simon, if you can give us a little bit of your understanding and how representations and warranties and indemnities really work, and maybe more in the context of, you know, say a primary deal and when these happen, how do they work, what are market norms, and what have you really seen?
Thanks, Karan. So I think, you know, every investment deal, you spend a lot of time on understanding what a representation really is. And sometimes people, you know, wonder whether it is a substitute for a due diligence. And the answer to that is obviously not. There are, you know, there are requirements as to why you need a representation and warranty and why you require due diligence. the words representations and warranties, again, are not just, you know, made up or are not used in conjunction with each other for no reason. They actually serve different purposes, and they have different legal remedies, assuming one or the other is breached. A representation, as Karan alluded to, is a statement of fact, could be present or in the past, in terms of what the statement really is, what the fact really is. A warranty, on the other hand, protects a party from losses if the future does not pan out in the way the present was actually stated. So a representation and warranty, you know, when clubbed together, serve different purposes, and that's why you would always have. Now, the first sort of statement or the first aspect that comes to mind is who has to give these representations and warranties, and what are they all about? You know, in a primary deal, you would have the
ladies and gentlemen, a request to stay connected. Please do not disconnect your lines as we're trying to reconnect the management. Thank you for your patience.
Representations and warranties, because if you're putting money into the company, what is the point of the company giving a representation if the, you know, if the sole purpose is to have a monetary claim against the company? Which is why the concept of a joint and several liability comes into being. Now, you know, whether the company gives a representation and warranty and what is the consequence of that, again, depends on the stake of stakes that the investor is actually buying in. Assume today an investor is investing 20% into the company, right? 80% of the company still doesn't really belong to that investor, and therefore it could be good. It could be a good consequence to have 80% a value still given by the company back. So the joint and several also works, you know, well, because in a joint and several representation and warranty, each of the promoters or each of the company is jointly as well as separately liable for what. For the statement that is being made. So the joint and several again is important, because then it is on the acquirer or the investor to then take the call as to which party it really wants to invoke the consequence of that breach of representation and warranty should the need arise. Corresponding to promoter and company giving joint and several representation is the corresponding consequence of what happens when there is a breach of that. Of that representation and warranty. And the typical consequence is you would have an indemnity clause backing that representation and warranty. And we will deal with, you know, what are the legal consequences of an indemnity versus the damages probably later, but there has to be a consequence or a monetary sort of monetary consequence should there be a breach of a representation and warranty. Typically, you know, when you have representations and warranties, you would have it divided into various subsections. Very often, you know, they're divided into fundamental warranties and business warranties. Fundamental warranties would be warranties that go into the very, you know, essence of the contract. For instance, if you're acquiring shares or investing in shares, the title of the share becomes a fundamental warranty. The authority of the company to enter into this document becomes a fundamental warranty. Aspects that relate to the business are not really fundamental because it doesn't really go to the root of the asset that you're buying, but it's looked at differently. And the reason why you have the segregations in terms of fundamental and non-fundamental is because the liability with respect to what is fundamental and what is non-fundamental changes accordingly. Now, in terms of, again, the plethora of representations and warranties, many times things are negotiated, you know, quite strongly. Because it's very easy to write that the company is in compliance with all laws. But in reality, you know, can you really make that statement? So the word material is very often sort of negotiated. What is really, you know, can you say the company is in compliance with all material laws? Can you otherwise, you know, move the word material about and say the company is materially compliant with all applicable laws? And the positioning of that word becomes, again, you know, extremely important, and how do you negotiate that? Now, again, what is material, what is not material? It depends from business to business. It could have just, you know, economic significance. It could have criminal significance. It could have various significances. And therefore, sometimes it is important to even define what material really means in the context of a representation and loyalty. The next thing that is often sort of defined and or negotiated is the word knowledge. Now, if you say today that the company is in compliance with all applicable laws, you know, is it a statement that you can make blindly? Because again, when you breach a representation, and a representation is a statement of fact, right? It is an absolute breach. You can't then go ahead and negotiate saying, you know, this is to the best of my knowledge. Because when you make a statement, it has to be, the statement is a statement of fact. If it's breached, there is a consequence to that. Which is why the aspect of knowledge becomes really important. So, can you negotiate to say that to the best of the company's knowledge, the company is in compliance with applicable law. The word again, knowledge, you know, especially for a corporate entity, what does that really mean, right? And I think we've gotten one of the most celebrated sort of cases that are landmark cases for India. In the Ranbaxy Daiichi deal, where the word knowledge was defined, redefined, and, you know, and narrow the scope of the representation and warranty, and we know the result of what really transpired there. So the word knowledge again is extremely important as to, you know, how you define it. It can differ for an individual promoter. It can differ for a corporate entity. For a corporate entity, one may expand the knowledge to include the knowledge of the board of directors. If you can expand the concept of knowledge to include or impute the knowledge of key persons also within the scope of, you know, of the representation and warranty, so that there is more than just the company making a statement. You know, the knowledge of more people is sort of imputed to giving that representation and warranty. In terms of when you have an entire list of representations and warranties, the question then arises is, you know, is this something that has to be absolutely true, or can you have certain exceptions to that representation and warranty, wherein you have a discussion of what disclosure schedule, where it is expected today that the promoters and the company will disclose to the investor things that could be exceptions to the representation and warranty. For instance, if you say that the company represents that the company is in compliance with all applicable laws, but you know, for instance, that there is a compounding application that is being made to the ROC, or there is certain non-compliances that the company knows of. It is best to disclose that to the investor so that that becomes an exclusion to the representation and warranty. And consequently, you know, if there is any consequence, any monetary consequence, that exclusion is looked at, and you're not liable for that exclusion when it comes to enforcement. So the disclosure letter is extremely also important. Now, when discussing the disclosure letter, again, there are, you know, various ways of doing a disclosure letter. You know, because the first concern of the company and the promoter is, look, I've opened my books to you, I've given you, you've looked at the company as a whole, you have to, you know as much with respect to the company that I know, and therefore, because I've disclosed the entire company to you and you've taken a cognizant call to come into the company despite, you know, knowing all of this, everything in the disclosure letter, everything in the data room that was disclosed as part of the diligence, you know, is deemed to be disclosed to you and is an exception, exclusion from the representations and warranties. Now, often that is a tall ask because at the end of the day, you know, assessing or looking at information specifically is not something that an investor necessarily has the expertise to do. And again, a diligence serves a very different purpose from a disclosure letter, from representations and warranties. A diligence is something that an investor needs to do to safeguard his own interests coming into the company. And it's done as a diligent or prudent method and not necessarily to limit the liability of the company or the promoter. And therefore, there is always that discussion of whether, you know, the entire data room should be disclosed or not, and so on and so forth. We have that debate. But typically, at least the standard for India seems to be to have a specific disclosure letter. We have, you know, disclosures that are specific and disclose against representations and warranties to the investor so that on the face of it, when an investor comes into the company, they know for sure that these are the liabilities that exist in the company. On the basis of which I will not really, you know, be able to, or you take a cognizant call as to what the impact of that with respect to your investment could be. Once you have a disclosure letter and you understand in terms of the legal diligence, you could also have certain specific indemnities, wherein a loss which has not been, or a valuation concern that has not been factored into your valuation can be specifically indemnified, especially if the liabilities are contingent liabilities, for instance, an outstanding tax issue or a financial concern which is contingent, which you don't really know, is something that you can specifically have as a specific indemnity. So should that liability crystallize, it is the obligation of the company and the promoter to indemnify you. Sort of last but not the least is the concept of gross out. So when you have an indemnity clause, especially given by the company, and it depends again on, you know, what stake of the company you're actually acquiring. If you're acquiring a large enough stake, or you're acquiring a stake which is sort of meaningful, you may say, look, you know, if the indemnity is dollar for dollar, then technically speaking, you know, I'm getting 80 cents to a dollar, but the 20 cents are actually mine, but you may have a 20% stake in the company. Which is where the concept of gross up really comes into question, where you say, look, the indemnity cover for me is the loss plus the loss that I am actually giving myself, and you gross up to the extent of your shareholding so that you are sort of made whole with respect to this loss. Now, so we can go ahead and, you know, and have a day-long discussion of what loss really is and how to define loss and what that really means. But I think I'm going to stop here in terms of what, you know, what the market stand for primary deals really is, and maybe pass on the baton to somebody else.
Thank you, Mon. In fact, that was really insightful as far as, you know, the overall landscape on what even indemnities works and primary deals. Nishir, you have great experience on a lot of these, both on the M&A and B side. What is your perspective on how this paradigm shifts, you know, when you talk about secondary deals, whether it's in the M&A or the PE context? And if you could share some thoughts there.
Sure. So as far as secondary deals are concerned, I think a lot depends on who is giving the warranties. And this becomes important given the fact that there are more and more private equity sellers who have limited fund life. And at the same time, there are more and more individual founders who are selling their stakes. So how do you... of what kind of protection as a buyer you take from the individual founders or from the private equity sellers, given the fact that, you know, there is always this sword which is hanging on the fund life, or whether the founder will be able to pay the indemnity in case there is a breach of warranty. Now, there are four or five situations which we have encountered when it comes to secondary deals. Let me start with the simplest one, which is, let's say there is a 80% stake which a founder is owning and 20% stake which a private equity investor is owning, and there is a put option at fair market value on the Indian promoter. I think that's the simplest situation where the private equity seller is selling. What the private equity seller will give is basic fundamental warranty on title of shares, authority, capacity. Typically in these situations, the indemnity cap would be 100%, and because these are all fundamental warranties, you know, there is no time limit on survival of these warranties. So this is the simplest situation. The second situation is where, let's say, there is a private equity player owning 20% in a company, 80% by the promoters, and one PE is selling to another PE. Now, again, if it's a plain vanilla PE to PE sale without any involvement of the company or the promoter, the selling PE will only give fundamental warranties to the buying PE, again, restricted to title of shares, authority, capacity, and the same indemnity caps and time period for survival of the indemnity. But we have also seen situations where the PE to PE sale has been facilitated by the company and the promoter. In fact, in one situation, what had happened was the selling PE had invested in 2007 in an Indian company. And in 2011, there was an IPO exit which was supposed to be given to the selling PE by the company and the promoter. Somewhere, somehow the company and the promoter were not able to give exit to the IPO, and you know, then there was a buyback put, but none of these things worked out. What the promoter did, and this is again very, this is a very different kind of promoter you will not find in India, but this promoter actually went one step ahead and he spoke to another PE to buy the selling PE stake, and there was a mismatch in the valuation. The selling PE wanted 1x valuation, whereas the buying PE was willing to give only 0.8x valuation for the same stake. What the promoter did was he himself diluted to the extent of a 0.2x valuation, and at the same time, in addition to the fundamental warranties with the PE, selling PE gave to the buying PE, the company also gave business warranties to the buying PE. Now, again, this is very, very, it's a corner case, doesn't happen in all the deals in India, but these are also, you know, these type of deals do happen in, you know, one-off cases. The third situation, the way we have seen is, you know, there is a minority PE investor and there is a promoter. So let's take the same example, 20% by minority PE, 80% by the promoter. And there is a buyout fund which wants to buy, let's say, 70 or 80% of the company, right? Now, in this situation, assume that promoter, the selling PE is completely exiting to the extent of 20%, and the promoter is partially exiting out of 80%, promoter is selling 40%. So let's say the buying PE or the buyout fund is taking, you know, 60 to 70% stake in the company. In these type of situations, again, the selling PE typically take a stand that, you know, we are not controlling the company, we are financial investors. What we can give is only fundamental warranty to the extent of title, authority, capacity. And the promoters typically end up giving the business warranty. Given the fact that promoters are exiting to the extent of 40%, which is almost double the stake where the PE is selling. From a buying PE perspective, he gets both the fundamental warranties from the promoter and the PE and business warranties from the promoter. Now, the more tricky situation comes up, and this is what we have been dealing with in number of cases these days, because what has started happening in India, like in developed jurisdictions, is there are more and more buyout funds which are taking controlling stakes in Indian companies. And when buyout funds take controlling stakes in Indian companies, it becomes very tricky when these buyout funds are exiting later on, because the way they work is, you know, they have a substantial shareholding, but they still rely on the founder or the promoter with respect to day-to-day operations of the company. So it becomes tricky to give some of the business warranties at the time of exit. So let's take one situation where 60% is owned by a buyout fund and 40% is owned by the promoter, and there is a 80% stake which is going to be acquired by a new buyout fund. So the existing buyout fund is selling 60%, promoter is selling 20%, and the new buyout fund is owning 80%. Now here it becomes very tricky because, you know, even though the selling buyout fund is owning 60%, the only insight that it has as far as the reps and warranties of the company are concerned is through the board seat which they have. And, you know, not everything comes to the board. There are many things which happen between two board meetings. The day-to-day operations of the company are run by the business heads, the CFO, the CEO, and the exiting buyout fund, apart from having knowledge about some of the critical decisions which are supposed to come to the board as per the requirements of the Companies Act, they have actual knowledge only of those things, typically. And that's why what becomes challenging in these type of situations is how do such type of buyout firms give business warranties. And this is a very tricky situation. We have seen different deal, different arrangements being negotiated for different types of deals, depending on what percentage stake, what is the involvement of the buyout fund in the company. But there is no market standard on this. In one of the deals, we had also seen where a promoter took on the obligation to give business warranties in spite of the fact that you know, promoter was owning a very minuscule percentage. But at the same time, different different deals will give you different outcome in these type of situations. In one of the other deals which we are currently doing, and you know, this is a crucial point which is being negotiated as we are speaking, is there are three selling fee investors who are owning 25% each in a company, and the promoter owns the balance 25. Now, who gives business warranties in this situation? 75 on one hand, individually if you see all three PE investors are owning 25%, each of them can take a stand that, listen, we are like minority. In all of our companies, we take some, you know, below 25% stake. So we are not, and we our presence is only through the board, right? So we will not be able to give anything beyond the fundamental warranty. But at the same time, from a buyer perspective, he's looking at a block of 75% and the promoter is selling 25%. So who gives business warranties in these situations? So as I mentioned, you know, different shareholding percentages create different complications depending on who is owning those shareholding percentages. Another issue which comes up is, you know, in these type of situations where there are three P's owning 25% each, sometimes the buyer asks for a joint and several representation, warranty and indemnity. Now, the tricky issue which comes up is obviously, no, one buyer, one selling PE does not want to take on the obligation of other selling PE. So ultimately it ends up being several, because, you know, only in case of the sellers who are affiliates, who are, you know, joint promoters of the company, the joint and several concept works. But when the sellers are different, private equity funds, or are not connected to each other, the concept of joint and several doesn't work. Third type of situation within the same could be a bidding situation. Now, in bidding situation, you know, the sellers typically have an upper hand, because if you have four or five bidders who are ultimately in the last round, then the selling PE investor can negotiate that, listen, if you want this bid to be won, then, you know, we are not going to give any business warranties. You have to rely on your diligence, and at best, whatever the promoter can give as far as business warranties are concerned, be happy with that. Otherwise, you know, we have choice of other four bidders also that we can choose from. So in a bidding situation, the seller has an upper hand compared to the buyer. We are also currently working on a couple of portfolio buyout deals. Now, this is a very new concept in India, where instead of just selling one portfolio company, you are selling stake in, let's say, four or five portfolio companies, or maybe 8 to 10 portfolio companies. Now, how do you negotiate warranty and indemnity in these type of situations? And it becomes very tricky, because the stakes in different portfolio companies could be different. So let's say if there are 10 portfolio companies, in 3 portfolio companies, the seller may just have 15%. In 3 portfolio companies, seller may have 35 to 40%. And in 1 or 2 portfolio companies, seller may be controlling shareholder in the company. So how do you segregate these portfolio companies into, let's say, minority versus substantial minority versus substantial majority? And then you segregate the reps and warranties for these portfolio companies depending on these three categories. So if it's a substantial majority, that means there is a lot of insight into the operations of the company, because the selling PE also has right to appoint the CEO, CFO, and, you know, it's their people who are running the company. So they can pretty much give the same warranties as a normal promoter would be able to give in an M&A or a PE deal. If it's a substantial majority, which is like you are between 25 to, let's say, 50%, then you are somewhere in between, you know, minority and substantial majority, where the promoter or the founder is running the show, but you may have one or two board seats on the company. So there, in these situations, what we have seen, again, as I mentioned earlier, it depends on the negotiation power of both parties, how much the buyer is able to extract from the seller, or seller is able to ensure that the buyer lets go some of these things. And if you are purely a minority with 15-20%, then you know, you restrict yourself to only fundamental warranty. The other issue which comes up in this portfolio buyout deals is that typically most of the offshore funds, they invest to multiple funds. So they have series 1 fund, series 2, series 3. a lot of other, lot of funds, it's like Series 8 to 10 going on. And these funds, they keep investing from multiple funds in Indian portfolio companies. So for example, Fund 1, Fund 2 may could have invested in Company A. Fund 2, Fund 3 could have invested in Company B. Fund 1 and Fund 3 could have invested in Company C. Now how do you negotiate the indemnity cap for the fund? Because again, each fund will have a different LP base. So you cannot say that, you know, the liability of Fund 1 can be passed on to Fund 2, even though the GP may be the same for all the funds. Ultimately, you have to see who are the LPs. So that's another nuance which comes up where you look at ultimately which fund has investment in various companies. You consolidate all the indemnity caps and time limits and everything at that fund level instead of looking at it at the portfolio company level. Another important issue which comes up you know, in portfolio buyout deals, and this is not specific to warranties, but again, something to do with deal certainty, because when you are doing 8 to 10 or let's say 4 to 5 portfolio company deals, how do you ensure deal certainty? So not all deals may close at the same time. You have to, the sellers have to deal with the promoters, the shareholders, there will be multiple right of first offer, right of first refusal, tags in various shareholders agreement. So some companies may close earlier, some companies may close later. How do you ensure that there is deal certainty where you are closing 4 companies and rest of the 6 companies will also close? So this is another interesting thing which comes up when, you know, you are buying a portfolio, and you know, it becomes important on how as a buyer you ensure deal certainty. So broadly, Karan, these are the points which you know, become important when you are looking at
it. I think a lot of insightful and interesting nuances you picked up, and I think it will form basis of things we want to discuss more also in the second part of insurance. But before that, I wanted to actually get Mandira your views, right? You would have seen a very, very, I would say, a macro picture of how these things work. It, you know, the whole ambit of what exists out there, right? And being somewhat of an outsider, not the lawyers, is actually fighting each of these through. What is your perspective on what you've really seen in the market, some takeaways or some peculiarities that you've noticed?
No, absolutely. So I think what Nishchal and Simon both said is exactly what we see in most of the deals that as an insurance advisor that we've seen. We've seen situations where we've actually seen a lot more on in terms of a well-negotiated SPA. I think that is one of the key requirements that we typically see on a transaction that we're looking at. But having said that, we've seen across the board, we've seen transactions which are minority transactions, the primary transactions where the disclosure mechanism might just be a fairly disclosed mechanism. Vis-a-vis, there might be situations where we've seen that anything which has been disclosed in the data room in the business report is a standard. In secondary deals, which are a lot more common that we see that I have seen in my experience, we've seen situations where the private equity fund, which might be the majority owner, might be the one who might be making most of the money from the exit, are the ones who are only providing fundamental warranties, and while all the other warranties are being provided by the promoter who might be holding minority stake. So pretty much in line. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to let the lawyers comment more on the SPA, but absolutely, we've seen across the board, we've seen situations where they might just be fundamental warranties, and they've been able to negotiate an SPA without any of the other tax warranties or business warranties. But that is situations where the seller obviously has an upper hand compared to what the buyer is. So it depends a lot on the negotiations, how the negotiations are going, and which party has an upper hand in while negotiating the SPA.
Right, Mark, your perspective here, and quickly, right? You've seen the difference that an Indian deal has, an Indian peculiarity has against what more common somewhat for you, I guess, you know, from the English law perspective, UK deals, and how does it vary? You want to give us some insight?
Sure. I think the main difference that we're seeing at the moment between the Indian market and particularly the UK market is we've had a very seller-friendly market in the UK for quite some time. So we're seeing warranties given in SPAs that are much closer to the initial seller auction draft than you might otherwise see. I think in India it's fair to say it's more of a buyer's market, and the warranty packages that are being given probably are more nearer to what you would see in US-style SPAs than what you'd see in English-style SPAs. So I think there's an environment in which you have probably more buyer-friendly documents generally as a market standard, but also the prevailing market conditions at the moment are probably one of a buyer-friendly market versus what we have in the UK. And part of the UK being such a seller-friendly market, it means that there's a lot of auctions. And in those really competitive scenarios where you've got
portions that may even be done within the space of 1 to 2 weeks, you have very little negotiation of the warranties, and it might mean that the package is incredibly seller-friendly, very limited, versus what you might see and expect on an Indian transaction. But otherwise, in terms of the dynamic and the issues that we see on a deal-by-deal, we really are seeing much the same as what Mandira, Nishal and Simone have mentioned. So we're picking out a couple of those points. The dynamic with private equity firms that want to not stand behind the warranties other than title and capacity has meant that we're very frequently asked to ensure a transaction in which the management warrantors are liable for the business warranties only, with the institutional investor liable for title and capacity. So that's a dynamic that lends itself to an insurance firm getting involved. And also the other point that Nishal made on funds and having different LP mixes within different vintages of funds. And again, we're looking at portfolios of disposals within fund structures and looking to create policies that wrap around that so that we can ensure that liability is ring-fenced within a particular fund vintage. And they're not looking to a GP, which might be a capitalized entity, or different LPs from a future vintage of the fund.
Yeah. So, Mark, just to sort of get back to what one of the points that Yash made is, it's important to sort of distinguish between the giver of the warranty and the consequent holder or the indemnity provider, right? Because it may not be the same person. So, for instance, if you have a situation where management is making representations and warranties, it's not necessary that management itself is also giving the indemnity as well. There could be circumstances where the private equity guys or the selling shareholder or the promoter shareholder may sort of look to somebody else to give the representations and warranties and be okay to take the liability or a part of the liability, or say, you know, 10% of the consideration is locked in for a breach of this, but I have no standing to actually give this because I have no role to play in the company. So I think that dynamic is important. I'm sure we'll get into it at the insurance stage, but that dynamic is important to understand.
Interesting. You know, a couple of interesting concepts came out here, and there's something that I thought, Simone, if you can just spend a couple of minutes telling us all about indemnities, and then there's this whole bucket of damages, right? How the two interplay? What is the interplay between the two? Are they similar? Are they covering one versus the other? If you could just share a little bit about that and, you know, the nuances around that, and, you know, without me coming back, Mishra, if you after that can add on to some of these structures of constructs people deal with, right? You heard of holdback, escrow, more in tune with the secondary stuff that you spoke about a few minutes ago. So, you know, if you could hear from both of you on this, and, you know, before we move on to our next set of topics on insurances.
Sure. So I think the fundamental sort of difference between damages and indemnity is that, A, first and foremost, damages is a statutory right granted by the Indian Contract Act. So if there is a breach of a contract, you can sue for damages. An indemnity is a special contract agreed between parties, and is not subject to the rigors of what the damage consequence really is. Under the Indian sort of Contract Act, a damage can only be granted for a loss that is foreseeable or arises in the natural course of things. An indemnity, on the other hand, is an indemnity protection for losses that is caused, you know, based on how the contract is actually worded. So if you see the Indian Contract Act, specifically Section 73 of the Indian Contract Act, makes it clear that you can't really get, you know, remotely or consequential damages as by way of right. Whilst these rigors or these restrictions do not apply when an indemnity contract really exists. So you have the ability to maneuver or to create your own contract for loss, for protection of loss. In the event of an indemnity vis-a-vis a damage. Again, you know, in terms of damage, it goes to the performance of the contract. An indemnity can be wider for any loss covered under in terms of the scope that you've actually agreed for. In terms of damages, it is usually given by the person who has actually breached the contract. An indemnity, on the other hand, can be given by any person for a third party loss. So the scope of an indemnity is far wider than damages. But at the root of each of these remedies is a loss to recourse. You can't really have an indemnity for a loss that has not arisen for you. An indemnity, again, you don't really have to first suffer the loss and then claim an indemnity. Even before incurring a third party loss, you can actually sue and get an indemnity recovery. Having said that, all of that, you know, is governed by how you draft the contract. Most often, you have limits that apply to the indemnity clause. You ensure that the loss that is indemnifiable is only for a direct loss. Most often, sellers are very nitpicky on what losses are actually indemnifiable, and often exclude consequential losses from the indemnifiable loss as well. Again, you have limitations. You have de minimis thresholds, wherein you know there is a maximum limit on the basis over and above which you can't really have an indemnity loss indemnifiable. All of these are contractually agreed and discussed. We've seen situations where the indemnity cover could be 1x. Sometimes in certain circumstances can go above 1x. It can be 30% of the consideration, but it's all a function of what has been agreed and what has been negotiated, and could vary from. The thresholds can actually vary. You also have limitations of time for an indemnity clause. You have a limitation of typically 3 years for business representations and warranties. You typically have an unlimited time limit for fraud, and an unlimited sort of cap for aspects arising out of fraud. And you have, fundamental warranties can also be timed, or there is no real limit. And you have typically 7 to 8 years for a tax or warranty. All of these relate back to the statute of limitations that we have in India, which have 3, 7, 8 year limitations, etc., that apply under statute of limitations, which is where these timelines have been sort of picked from. I think that is sort of the basic difference between damages and an indemnity, and why you have long sort of discussions with respect to indemnity. They don't solely rely on damages as a monetary relief.
Sure. So just to answer your question on the structures which are typically used for indemnity protection, I think in May 2016, the Reserve Bank of India liberalized the regulations for creating escrows for indemnity. And the law now is that if there is a transaction between a resident to non-resident or a non-resident to resident, there is a period of 18 months which has been provided to create an indemnity escrow. So once you have paid, let's say, 100% of the consideration to the seller, then you have 18 months to put a certain amount back into escrow. That amount, again, there is a limit of 25% of the total purchase consideration or the sale consideration, which can be used for the purpose of indemnity. So that's one major relaxation which has been brought in. As far as the concept of escrow is concerned, and again, I'm talking more from a generic perspective rather than exchange control regulations. Escrow is typically used in a situation where, let's say, the buying PE investor or the strategic acquirer does not have comfort with the selling individual. That, when the money sale consideration goes to the selling individual, that money is not going to remain intact. He may do some estate planning or trust planning, and that money can be ring-fenced in a manner where when the buyer wants to claim indemnity, that money is not available. Or in a situation where, let's say, the selling PE fund is at the fag end of the fund life, maybe just let's say only 6 to 12 months of the fund life is remaining, and the money has to be distributed back to the LPs or the investors, and in that situation, how do you protect the indemnity amount in case there is a breach of warranty? So I think fund life issues, typically for private equity investors, we haven't seen too much for breach of fundamental warranties, because there is a lot of comfort which is typically there with the investor or the acquirer that the fundamental warranties won't be breached. But when it comes to tax indemnity, which we'll discuss later, at that time the fund life becomes important to deal with, and what are the nuances which we have seen, what type of structures we have seen, what type of negotiations we have seen when it comes to tax indemnity. But that maybe we can take later.
Sure. No, thank you, Chet. I guess it's pretty clear we're not seeing any transactions without warranties and indemnities in their infrastructure to deal with it. Mandir, I wanted to come over to you and, you know, kind of discuss the second topic here that's important. What is this reps and warranties insurance? And, you know, as you speak, if you can touch upon a few aspects of course, what this is, what is the product really, why is this product, why does it exist, why do you really need it, right? And also some practicality, when do people actually come to you? When should actually some parties be thinking about this? When is the right time to approach for a product like this? How should they kind of prepare for it? And, you know, and maybe an overall scene of, you know, what the costs involved are and where this lies.
Sure, thanks. I think what we've been discussing so far, the various situations that Nishal and Simone have seen across the transactions, I've actually been able to think of how a warranty indemnity insurance would be applicable in all those situations. But before I get into when we can use warranty indemnity insurance, I think one thing I want to say upfront is the fact that what does this product cover? The product is meant to cover your unknown issues. The product is not meant to cover things which are already known to the insured. Now, if what is expected of the parties of both buyer and seller is that there should be a thorough disclosure that the seller should be doing. Having a warranty indemnity does not replace how a normal negotiation process should go on. The seller is still required to make a thorough disclosure. At the same time, the buyer is required to do thorough diligence of the asset they're acquiring. This does not substitute any of those. So the idea of the product is that the buyer has done a thorough diligence, the seller has done thorough disclosure, but there are still things which could be unknown. I'm sure the buyer still can't put his hand on heart to say that he knows everything about the asset. And that's exactly what it's there to do. It's there to cover unknown historical facts, things that either the seller might have not disclosed to the buyer, misrepresented, which is fraud, which is covered in a buyer-side policy. I'll come back to how the two types of policies work. But that's one thing. Or the fact that the thing the seller did not know at the time of doing the transaction, and any of that happened because of a breach of a representation in India. I think that's the first issue. Now, given that it's an unknown, like people ask, why is it that this product is, you know, used? I mean, if it's only unknown, you know, we're quite certain about the fact that, you know, we've done a good diligence, why should we use this product? And I think just drawing upon the experiences of both Simone and Nishal, it could be a situation where a private equity fund has a limited fund life. Now, we know private equity funds are sponsors, right? They are happy to give fundamental warranties because obviously that is one thing. They know about the share, they know about the capacity they can get through a transaction. But are they sure they can give business representation? They are not the guys who are running the business day-to-day. They have a management team, promoters who are running the business. But if they are majority holders in the asset, they are required. So that's one classic example of why we've seen extensive use. Or they might not have the fund life. I mean, the statute in India is that you need tax warranties to be covered for 7 years, you want your general warranties to be covered for 3 years, and private equity funds might not have the luxury of having a fund life remaining. It could be a situation where it could be an auction process where a buyer is using the product to enhance his bid. So there could be a transaction that is going on and there are various suitors. As a buyer, he could go to the seller that, Mr. Seller, I'm going to staple an insurance policy along with my bid. So when you're looking at my bid, you're actually getting a clean exit. I'm the one who's going to place the policy in place. Therefore, while you have to still make representations, you don't necessarily need to stand behind those representations. I have an insurance policy which will pick up any losses that might happen. It could be a situation where the buyer is not comfortable with the seller's reputation, creditworthiness, intention. I don't know what circumstances that, say, might have happened. It could be that the company has a lot of debt and that's why they're making a sellout. So that's the other thing, when you're not sure about the other party. In a minority deal, we've seen situations where a private equity might see some losses from a breach, but does he really want to spoil his relationship with the promoter? I mean, we've seen a lot of times promoters, private equity actually let go of those claims because they're saying, fine, it's a small loss I've borne, but it's a partnership that I have with the promoter. Do I really want to, you know, make a claim and ruin that partnership? But having a warranty indemnity actually helps them make a claim of even those losses where they don't need to go to the seller and therefore do not need to spoil their key relationship. We've seen situations where there are escrows or holdbacks that are required. Now, obviously, cash is king. If the buyer is able to get an escrow, I'd be lying if I say you should replace that with a warranty indemnity. But what about the seller? The seller doesn't have an idea about the proceeds that he will get from a sale. So various strategic uses that we've seen in the market about, when to use the product. But the fact is the product can be used by both buyer and the seller. In fact, a number of times it's the seller who initiates the process, because at the end of the day, it's the seller who's providing the reps and warranties and the SCA. They're the ones who need to stand behind the indemnities. But by having a warranty indemnity in place in the name of the buyer, they're actually helping themselves get a clean exit. They can actually walk away from the transaction having limited recourse or a nil recourse. Just in terms of some of these, how the structures work is that depending who the insured is in the policy, you could either have a buyer policy or a seller policy, which means if it's a buyer policy, it's the buyer who's insured and therefore has a contract with the insurance company to make a claim. Or it could be a seller policy, which could be in a situation where it's like a reimbursement for a promoter where they still owe the buyer in from an SCA point of view if there's a loss, but then they can go and claim that money back from you.
Very interesting to know. Maybe Andrew, give us a perspective on what this policy looks like. Is it very different if it's a buyer policy or a seller policy? Are there different types of policies that go around depending on, you know, we've heard terminologies such as US style policies and others. What's that? And, you know, without maybe getting very technical since we have a mixed audience, but what are the key terms in this policy? What do you cover? What is included? Can you give us a little bit of overview from your experience in that?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. So you're absolutely right. There are policy differences between the US and the rest of the world. Just practically speaking, I think it's worthwhile mentioning that each policy is bespoke. The insured would work with the broker and the underwriter to craft a policy that achieves the commercial objectives in accordance with what has been agreed in the SCA between the parties. So the point there is that we endeavour to have the policy sit back to back with the SCA. What you can recover from the seller under the SBA, you would be able to recover under the insurance policy. So, Karen, you picked up on a point on the two types of policies, one being a sell-side and one being a buy-side policy. So the key differences there are that on the sell-side, as the name suggests, we're insuring the seller, and on the buy-side, we're insuring the buyer. But ultimately, it's the same risk. It's the warranty given by the seller or the promoter. And so for a buy-side policy, one of the key features is that the insured buyer can claim solely against the insurer and just leave the seller completely out of any claim for a warranty breach. Under the sell-side policy, the key difference here is that in order for the seller to seek indemnity from the insurer, the buyer would need to claim for warranty breach under the terms of the FDA, and then upon the seller receiving that claim, would then seek indemnity from the insurer. One of the key coverage differences between a sell-side and a buy-side policy as well is that under a sell-side policy, if the sellers themselves have been fraudulent, we wouldn't be able to cover that because that would also constitute seller fraud for the purpose of insurance law, and we wouldn't be reimbursing the seller for their own fraud. But under a buy-side policy, we would, of course, cover fraud of the seller as one of the key features of the buy-side policy. I think taking all those factors in the round, what we found is the growing trend both in India and globally is that we're seeing far more submissions for buy-side insurance than we are for sell-side insurance. And I think based on 2016 statistics in EMEA, the split was 95% buy-side versus 5% sell-side. So quite a big swing there. Another question was, what does the policy look like? What are some of the key exclusions? So, at a very practical level, if you're looking at a UK policy versus a US policy, a UK policy will really focus on the warranties themselves and have a warranty catalogue, which will take you through whether each warranty is covered or excluded or covered to a form of words that the insurer is willing to cover. That is in stark difference to the US policy, which doesn't have that feature. Now, does it really impact on coverage? Not really, but it's just really suggesting that both insurance markets, the policy really grew up in both M&A markets, and I think it really reflects the differences in M&A done between, say, the US and the UK, or Germany as well. There are key differences in how M&A is conducted. And likewise with India, there are certain quirks and certain unique aspects as to how M&A is done in India, which really flow through into the policy. Again, picking up on that point that it is a bespoke product, and it's really there for meeting those commercial objectives to the buyer. One of the other aspects that I think is key to note is that it's really not just a risk transfer product. We're not just transferring the risk from the seller to the insurer. It's there for strategic use. And Mandira picked up on the point that a buyer can differentiate their fees by using insurance. What we're really meaning there is that the seller can reduce its overall liability, but still give warranties and still have meaningful warranties. The reason why they're meaningful is because the insurer is standing behind them. And just, I'll finish on this point, because Tony, you asked about exclusions, and of course, it is absolutely standard for an insurance policy to have exclusions. And what those exclusions are, typically transfer pricing, which would be excluded, on property transactions, it's construction defects, secondary tax liabilities, asbestos, issues known to the buyer, and again, that really just reflects what you've come to practice in M&A, and that is that whatever the buyer knows, he really should be able to claim under the warranty. There are various regional differences in that approach, but it is generally speaking a fairly core concept. Again, picking up on that disclosure point that Simone made earlier. There are, at times, deal-specific exclusions. I think, as a general comment on exclusions, I'm being asked to speak a bit loud.
Just be a bit loud.
Yeah, okay. Just a key point on the exclusions is that, generally speaking, if diligence has been undertaken on an issue, and the issue is a reasonable issue in the context of the business, then underwriters generally try to work to provide coverage. But for those issues that can't be underwritten, that are completely unknown, or where other insurances or other risk mitigation practices are in place, and those risk mitigation practices are commonplace for the business that is being bought, then generally speaking, they wouldn't be included in the overall coverage package provided by the insurance policy. So some of the issues there would be pensions. There's really no appetite for insurance companies to take on pensions liabilities. There are other risk mitigants that can be applied to compensate or make up any pension liabilities. In terms of other insurance policies, property policies, or insuring general assets of a target company, if there is an insurance coverage in place that provides coverage for those types of issues, then WNI will either exclude those issues or see the excess of it. And so just trying to explain that a bit further, what we're trying to do is pick up transaction liability. We're not really picking up the general business risks and general business liabilities. The transaction liability stems from the warranty, and any breach of those warranties which result in loss is what we're really trying to get at in terms of coverage under the WNI policy.
Very helpful, Angus. Mark, I want to get your thoughts on a couple of things here, since you're closer to some of the Indian deals where you've seen insurance in place. How are they really priced? How do you come up with the pricing and costing for such policies? And, you know, typically it's still possible that if I want to buy side, that the sell side picks up the cost and things like that. And the other thing I wanted to understand from you and get a perspective is, have you seen claims? Have they really happened? What are the claim processes? And, you know, you and I were talking earlier about some numbers if you could throw out and share with us. But I guess that's what people want to know, right? But it boils down to
absolutely
how it plays out.
So, first of all, in terms of the cost of the product in the first place, so what we're seeing in the market, and I'm sure that Mandira Marsh will have a view of the wider market as well, but what we are seeing is that policies tend to be priced between 1.5% and 3.5% of the limit that's purchased. And it's important just to pause there as to what that limit is. And typically that is 20 to 30% of the enterprise value of the transaction. And so, firstly, in terms of where a deal will fit on that spectrum, the biggest factor...
Sorry, and just one more point. That is a one-time cost at the start of the policy. So the pricing that has been mentioned is the one-time at the start of the transaction, and it's typically going to cover you for the full statute which has been agreed in the MD. Sorry, Mark.
So in terms of where the price for a particular policy falls within that range and the typical amount of the EV that's insured, we tend to see that the larger proportion of the EV that's insured in isolation, the lower the rate online will be. And the reason for that is because the more limit is purchased as a proportion of the EV, the less likely it will be that there's going to be a full limit loss under the insurance policy. So that mitigating factor can be brought through into the pricing. There will be a number of other factors that won't be a surprise. Realistically, they'll go to the general sense of how risky a transaction is. So you'd be looking at the jurisdiction, the sector, the current owners, and looking at those in turn. Obviously, you won't need me to explain why there's some jurisdictions and sectors that are more risky than others. But in terms of the current ownership structure, it may well be the case that if we have a PE seller, we can be a bit more comfortable about corporate governance than if we had an individual seller. And in other scenarios, there may well be a buyer that has experience of running businesses of the same nature as the target, so we think they have a better understanding of the risk and can scope them into the diligence. And also the overall process that's been run. So the underwriting really is looking at the negotiation of the warranties and the way in which that has operated between the two parties, going through diligence that backs them up and the disclosure against the warranties. And really what we're looking for is for the transaction to be run in a way that suggests it would have been the same as if there wasn't insurance. And all of these factors are taken into account and weighed up and will have a bearing on pricing. But really it's the rate, it's the limit as a proportion of EV, target, sector and jurisdiction that are the most important.
Just to add, picking up on one point that Michelle made, and what we're also particularly interested in is really understanding who knows what and how that interacts with the disclosure standard and how, in fact, disclosure is regulated under the FCA. And that's a really key point, because what we're really wanting to ensure, and again, what Mandira said, is a full and thorough disclosure process. So what we're seeing in Europe grow as a trend is nil-till recourse FCAs. I think that's probably a feature of the fact that it is such a, there are various factors that would explain it, but it does stem from the fact that private equity doesn't like any warranties, and WI insurance is such a common feature of how private equity transactions are conducted. But nil to the recourse, we do insure, but it does come with an additional premium, additional cost, because there's really no incentive for the sellers or the individuals giving the warranties make a full and thorough disclosure, because they're not liable for anything under that FCA. It's a dynamic that is a reality, and therefore we do ensure it. But there are ways to underwrite it, and I think that it is probably something that we're going to be seeing in the year and the not too distant future.
We have already done a few of them for transactions where there's private equity funds, where there's been a good level of diligence done, and we've actually been able to do transactions with a nil recourse. And seller nil recourse means that the only recourse that the buyer has is insurance policy. The seller actually gets the ultimate clean exit, where the seller is happy to pay the premium, maybe. I mean, we've seen situations where the premium is completely paid by the seller, so it's been split between the two of them 50-50, in whatever form or fashion. And insurers don't care what has been commercially agreed in terms of the premium, but we've seen situations where the buyer is happy to just have an insurance policy as a sole recourse. And like Gosh is saying, it's mostly true for situations where it's a private equity fund who's running the process. In fact, we've seen situations where the private equity fund from day zero has told all the suitors, all the buyers, that, guys, I'm a private equity fund. I'm not going to be standing behind these reps. So when you're providing me your offers, make sure that you take into the fact that there will be a warranty indemnity insurance stapled with this transaction, right? And what we've been able to do with the sellers is help them understand what is it from an insurance point of view that is available in terms of coverage and of things which are going to be covered, not covered. And the sellers have been able to successfully use that draft of the FCA in their auction process such that they're able to get the clean, absolute clean exit.
And a quick 30-second question to you. What's the timeline involved? Because, you know, a lot of these deals are time sensitive.
Sure.
And even if they aren't in the beginning, you always get time sensitive towards the end. What's the net time lag involved or parallel time involved for us to get insurance numbers?
I think the shortest answer is as soon as possible. As soon as you realize that it's probably a product that can be helpful in the deal negotiation, in the closure of the transaction. And like the point that was made, I don't think warranty indemnity insurance is meant for every transaction. There are situations in which it's going to be helpful. I'd be lying if I say you can use it in every transaction. And if there are circumstances which have already been unheard, which shows that there is a voluntary indemnity insurance that can be used, earlier the better. So what it helps do is get better coverage. You get that much more time to negotiate the policy with the insurers. The insurers have that much more time to get comfortable with the diligence that have been done, comfortable with the representations that have been made, and therefore a better coverage is provided. And it also helps the sellers know from upfront how much time it would take to get this transaction done. So the idea is as
The claims point that you mentioned, just to wrap up on that, the key finding that we have found from looking at all claims that have been made against our policies from 2011 through to 2014, the reason for not taking that right up to date is because it takes a little bit of time for claims to be analyzed, so it may skew the numbers slightly if we bring that right up to date. Was it 14% of the policies that we've written in that period globally resulted in a claim? So I think the incidence of claims is far higher than you would expect based on experience of working on M&A deals on the buy and sell side. And we've spoken throughout the presentation regarding a number of factors of how the product can be used strategically, and there may be scenarios where the recipient of warranties, for one reason or another, decide not to make a claim because they may feel the amount that they can recover is too low and they'll be throwing good money after bad. It may well be in a classic private equity scenario that it's not a huge issue that they want to risk putting their management team offside, where they're going to need to continue running the business, so they decide not to make a claim. Whereas in a world where the transactions are covered by insurance, I think you're seeing potentially a clearer picture of the amount of risk in a transaction. And so it's far higher and surprising because of that. Actually, in terms of that core number for the next period, that is expected to increase. And there'll be data that we'll release in the next 2 months or so that will show that will go up.
It's really interesting to know how
I'm just going to say, and forgive me for shameless promotion, but AIG will be releasing an updated claim study, which Mark just touched on in the next 6 weeks or so. But the 2016 version is available on the AIG website. And I think, and this is a point that Mark has made, and that is the insurance on insurance, the claims that you see, the report does take you through the types of warranty breaches that we've experienced globally and also regionally. Financial warranties and accounts warranties were certainly the most risky from the overall warranty package. So if you're not taking out insurance or you are, this report and our claims findings will take you through those points that you really should be focusing on in a FBO negotiation and really understanding from a quantitative perspective, or at least a global and regional perspective, those things that are really resulting in loss under a broad range of FBA.
Yeah, I think, just in our experience of advising you guys, I think, and especially also advising our clients, I think there are interesting things that we've sort of gathered over the time. One is the fact that, we've talked about how important the diligence is. So typically, AIG always appoints a counsel to verify or to relook at the diligence that has been done by the acquirer and to see, whether the diligence is standard, not standard, and how that really works. And when we advise, and, the lawyer's job is to ensure to see that the representations and warranties actually have a backing with respect to the diligence. So everything that you, in fact, do represent. Is there a basis in the diligence report, or is there a basis that on the basis of which such a representation has been made, so that the risk can be analyzed as to whether to insure or not insure that representation and warranty. So that's one sort of giveaway as to how to prepare for a insurance policy, is to ensure that your reps and warranties actually have backing, and it makes it simpler for the insurer to understand where they're coming from. That's one. The second is, there are a lot of times where you have huge discussions on how the indemnity clause really needs to work and how not. And I think and maybe you guys can sort of talk about that, is that the insurance policy absorbs the insurance applies where the insurance is going to be taken over. So you have a different sort of way of handling the insurance claim, which is governed by the insurance policy and doesn't really, you know, follow the entire indemnity claim process that is inbuilt into the FPA. So, as Mandira said, if there is a discussion that needs to be had, you can save a lot of time, especially on certain circumstances where the indemnity clause can doesn't really need to be negotiated. So, certain there if you have the indemnity for the insurance policy, you know, in advance. That's two. Three is in terms of, you know, the entire insurance policy. Now, there are various, and I think as Angus said, it is a bespoke sort of policy. It's not, you know, it's not a cookie-cutter draft which is just signed by all. And the various aspects that are typically negotiated. One is, of course, the pricing. There are limitations in terms of time. There are limitations in terms of retention amounts. There are limitations in terms of exclusions. What can or cannot is excluded from the policy on the basis of which you know, a policy is actually written out. And all of those aspects you know, relate to how risky the insurance product really is for, or how AIG sees risk in underwriting that deal, and the risk can be mitigated. If there is, you know, thorough diligence, and again, will depend on sector to sector, but at least where you see, where we see, or where counsel feels that the representations and warranties that have been negotiated have actually been negotiated and have not just been written down because somebody else is going to be sort of stepping into the shoes of the person, you know, indemnifying. So I think in having a robust policy and getting the best coverage, I think it's important to have these things in mind before or at the time of coming to insurance.
And likewise, I think it's worth mentioning that there are those limitations that Simone mentioned, but then there are also a suite of enhancements that we can offer through the WNI policy that aren't even reflected in the FPA. And I know that Mandira has secured for her clients quite a few enhancements. I can just run through quickly what some of those are, and Mark, to add some of your recent experience, but let's say you wanted to extend the general warranty period under the terms of the WNI policy, but that wasn't reflected in the SBA, that can be done. So instead of having, let's say, 6 months to claim under the SBA, we could extend that to 18 months or right up to a 3-year period that would be expected in the MA market. Knowledge scrapes. Simone mentioned how knowledge is important purposes of warranties. Given this is a biased market, perhaps this isn't hugely relevant, but we do sometimes see a broad knowledge qualification over all warranties, which would mean that you could only claim under the SBA, provided that the seller or the warrantor actually knew of the issue disclosed. So that is quite clearly a limitation on what we can cover. Under WNI insurance policies, we can switch that limitation off and cover you as if that knowledge qualification didn't apply, although note that it's not just as simple as switching off the entire warranty package. There would always be some warranties that, according to my standards, would normally be knowledge qualified. Mark, why don't I let you have a chance to add to what the enhancements are?
Sure. So they are the main two that we see, and on in terms of extending the limitation period, particularly where we're dealing with sales by closed-ended funds. It's actually quite common for us to top up limitation periods you know, beyond an initial period that they're willing to provide. And for us, going to the point that was mentioned earlier, as long as we're comfortable that the dynamic at the outset is there, that the warrantors are standing behind the warranties and that incentivized to disclose against them, it's quite easy for us to extend the limitation period because, you know, as an insurer, we're not. Too concerned with the issues that a fund would have with specific dates in future. Otherwise, the enhancements that we can provide are more strategic uses of the product to actually enhance offerings in the SPA itself. So, for example, we may say that a policy can attach at 1% of EV. A seller might, in its initial draft of the SPA, provide a cap of say, 10% of EV. And so the enhancement really, whilst it is for the benefit of the seller that the policy can bring that down, is really to the buyer's benefit to give the seller that lower recourse. And potentially the buyer can secure a lower price or in a competitive scenario may win the bid by offering lower recourse to the seller. So it's those three enhancements that we're really seeing most frequently, changing the limitations, extending warranty periods, and switching off knowledge qualification and also materiality qualification as well.
I think the point to remember is that you don't need to spend the negotiation hours in a boardroom trying to decide whether the indemnity cap to be given by the seller is 10%, 20%, 30%, while the buyer is asking for 40, 50, 50%. Or similarly, if the seller is looking to provide indemnity for 6, 12, 18 months and the buyer is looking for the full statute. I think one of the key messages that you can avoid all of that time spent on that negotiation, because you can have an insurance policy which can go far beyond what has been agreed in the SPA. You don't need to necessarily have the seller agree to what your internal risk assessment is and can have a policy which is a lot more dovetailed. It's a lot more suited for your internal risk purposes than what the seller is willing to offer. We've seen situations where, I've had discussions with lawyers and private equity funds. I wish I'd known about this, because I actually had to let go of a transaction because my IC would not give me an approval without having X amount of, coverage costs. And that's one of the things that can help, you can help have a policy in place and avoid those situations.
Extremely helpful. I think without eating too much into Q&A time, I want to touch upon the last topic, and Nishal, maybe you can lead with that. There's this entire different animal called tax indemnities, right? What is this? How does it differ from the indemnities we've been talking about all this while? And give us an overview of what you're seeing and what this really is and how it differs.
Sure. So, I think the concept of tax indemnity comes into picture because in India, when a seller sells shares of an Indian company, especially when the seller is a non-resident, then there is an obligation on the buyer to withhold tax before making payment to the seller. Now, the reason why this becomes important is most of the private equity investors or the sellers who are outside India, they come through intermediate jurisdictions like Mauritius or Singapore, Cyprus, Netherlands. Now, and most of them in the past have come through Mauritius. So the discussion most of the times has been around whether a Mauritius seller, when he's selling shares of an Indian company, whether he will get capital gains tax exemption as per the India-Mauritius tax treaty. Now, while the treaty is very clear, there is a Supreme Court ruling on Azadi Bachao Andolan that when a Mauritius entity is selling shares of an Indian company, as long as it has tax residency certificate issued by the Mauritius Revenue Authorities, that transaction would not be taxable in India. Having said that, time and again, the tax department keeps reopening some of these transactions where the Mauritius entity is a seller. And that's where the buyer perceives a risk that for some reason, even if there is a 0.01% chance of the tax department winning the case, then the buyer will be out of pocket, because the tax department will chase the buyer. Buyer would have already paid the full consideration to the seller. So the buyer will be suffering the tax of the seller. And that's where this concept of tax indemnity comes into picture, where the buyer will say that, I'm willing to pay you full 100% consideration upfront. But if at all, for some reason, there is a tax liability which comes upon this transaction, then you will be obligated to indemnify me to the extent of the tax amount which is levied by the tax department on me. Now, why this tax indemnity becomes tricky? This becomes tricky in situations where the selling investor is a private equity fund. And as we discussed, the private equity funds typically have limited life. A typical private equity fund would have 8 to 10 year life in a normal situation. And when you are at the fag end of the fund, that's where all the exits take place. So 6 to 7 years is anyways the time horizon for any investment, for an investment to exit. So if you're invested in second or third year of the fund and you are looking at selling at the end of 8th or 9th year, then you are only left with 1 or 2 years. On the other end, as far as the tax department is concerned, there is a period of 7 years for which the tax department can chase the seller. In fact, for buyer, there is not even any period of limitation for chasing the buyer for tax indemnity. But overall, as a market standard, what we have seen is 7 years is the tax indemnity period which is negotiated in private equity deals where the private equity fund is a seller. In some certain situations, we also seen 4 year period, and that 4 year also becomes important because the the limitation period for the tax department to first assess the transaction is 33 months from the end of the financial year in which the transaction took place. So 4 years is also something which we have seen in some of the deals. Between 4 to 7 years, the tax department have powers in case there is some income which is escaped assessment. So 4 or 7 years is something what we have seen, although 7 is more common than 4 years when it comes to tax indemnities. But what becomes important is the fund life. Now, if there are only 1 or 2 years which are left in the fund life and you have to give a 7-year tax indemnity, how do you do that? Which is where, you know, one of the things which comes up is, as far as sellers are concerned, obviously tax indemnity insurance is a product which is there in the market. But at the same time, what also happens is, you know, there's a lot of analysis which goes into the fund life. Because even the fund life as a concept is, it's not that straightforward. Typically, all funds have a rollover period of 1 plus 1. So even though the fund life is less than 10 years, then, there is always an extension of 1 plus 1. So you may, on one hand, it could be just 2 years of fund life left, but with the approval of the LPs or the investors, it could be 2 plus 1 plus 1. Plus, in lot of funds, in the fund document, there is a right which is available with the general partner to claw back certain amount from the limited partner or the investors for a period of 3 to 4 years in case there is a liability which comes on the fund. Now, this is where there is a lot of detailing which needs to be done if you are representing a buyer on what exactly is the real fund life for the selling PE investor. Other important thing which becomes interesting when you're negotiating tax indemnity is whether the selling entity which is selling shares to you, is it the fund entity or is it just a special purpose vehicle of the fund entity? Because if it's just a special purpose vehicle, and especially if it's just a single investment vehicle which is holding only this investment, chances are that once the exit happens, this SPV will be liquidated, and in which case there is no recourse once that entity is liquidated. So, is there a guarantor concept which is there where the fund guarantees the obligations of the SPV? There are situations where the selling entity may not be a fund entity, but it has 3 to 4 investments which it has in India through that entity. In which situation we have seen some of the buyers getting comfortable with the fact that fair enough, the assets of this fund are much more than the tax liability which could come up, and the exit horizon is also not very imminent. So to that extent, they were comfortable not going to the fund level to get a guarantee from the fund. Other important thing which also comes into picture is, although tax indemnity has been the most common way of addressing the tax issue, withholding tax issue, we have also seen in certain situations a nil withholding order which is taken from the tax department before any remittance is done. Although this is a very rare situation where typically the tax department takes a few weeks time before they issue this nil withholding order, and the deal timelines usually do not permit withholding orders to be the time for the withholding orders to be issued. But in certain situations we have seen these things happening. Another situation which we have also seen, and I think this will become important going forward, is, as we all know, the Mauritius and the Singapore and the Cyprus treaty, 3 treaties India has amended. And all the investments which the companies in these jurisdictions have made in India prior to 31st March 2017 have been grandfathered. Now, grandfathered doesn't mean that there won't be any tax on this. There could still be a potential tax if the tax department is able to prove that there was the structure was sham, or there was no genuine business purpose. Like, for example, under the Singapore India tax treaty, there is a provision that if your Singapore entity has been set up solely for the purpose of taking benefit of the treaty, then the tax department has a right to question the viability of the treaty benefits. So pre 31st March 2017, the status quo will continue, the same negotiation of tax indemnity, everything will continue going forward for investment made prior to 31st March. a lot of people think that the investments which will be made post 31st of March 2017, they will not have any challenge because now it's very clear the tax rate is 10% for long-term capital gains. Everybody has to pay 10% tax and now tax indemnity will no longer be an issue. In fact, the challenge is going to increase further because this 10% tax is subject to general anti-avoidance rules, which are going to be introduced from 1st April 2017. And the way the GAAR provisions are worded, the tax department has substantial powers to even recharacterize a transaction. So you may feel it's a long-term capital gain, but if the tax department is able to prove that this is not the character of the income, the character should have been something else, because of which the tax rate could be different from 10%, then you may end up in a completely different tax slab, which otherwise, as of today, if you sell, there was no issue. If it's capital gains, it's capital gains. Similarly, as you know, under the Mauritius India tax treaty, debentures are exempt. So if you sell debentures of an Indian company, then the Mauritius India tax treaty still gives an exemption to the Mauritius entity when you sell the debentures, because the tax exemption has been taken away only for shares. Now the question which remains is if your debenture is structured more like an equity instrument, where the redemption premium is linked to profits of the company and it's not a pure coupon which you will typically find in a lending arrangement, can the tax department recharacterize that instrument as equity instead of debenture and take a view that even though it is technically debenture, as per GAAR now it's shares, and hence, you know, we have the authority to recharacterize and tax it. So post 31st of March, the reps and warranties on tax are going to be very, very critical. In fact, we already started getting into negotiations on this, where one warranty which we have started asking when we are on the investing side is on GAAR, that you know your structure is going to stand the test of GAAR going forward, and if for any reason there is a breach of that warranty, then there will be a tax indemnity which will come into picture. Now this is again going to be very tricky in terms of negotiation, because neither the seller nor the buyer, neither seller's counsel nor the buyer's counsel or the tax advisor know what this representation means, because it's ultimately going to depend on what view the tax department is going to take on the warranty on general anti-avoidance rules. But this is going to be a very tricky issue in terms of negotiations for all the investments which are, or all the secondary deals which are going to close post 1st of April 2017. I think the other typical issue which are more or less common with normal indemnity provision is out of pocket, right? No seller, no buyer would want to go out of pocket in terms of any tax demand. So if tax department issues a tax demand on the buyer would want to first get it from the seller and then pay to the tax department. So it's not on a reimbursement basis, but first the cash has to be paid to the buyer. As far as the standard on the time limit, I already mentioned it's 4 or 7 years, although 7 is more common than 4. As far as the amount is concerned, typically what we have seen is it's between 2x to 3x of the tax liability. That's what the tax indemnity cap, which is typically negotiated. And the reason for that is 1x is for the tax amount, but there is also an interest and penalty component which could come into picture if there is a delay in payment of withholding tax, and to factor that interest and penalty, it is increased by additional 1 to 2x. So overall 2 to 3x is the tax indemnity cap that we have seen in deals.
Andrea, quickly, is there an insurance product around for the tax and tax reps and indemnities and anything you'd like to tell us?
Yeah, so the products that are available in the market are tax indemnity insurance. Now what it covers obviously depends a lot on what the risk is, what the underlying case facts are, and very unlike warranty indemnity insurance, which you know is again a very specific product depending on what kind of reps are being given. Similarly, even on the tax indemnity insurance, it's a lot depend on what is the underlying risk. Now, how the insurance availability would be dependent is how robust is the opinion which is being given on that risk. Opinion from law firms, opinion from accountancy firms. I think basis that is when insurers in general can have a view about is that something which is insurable or not. It's a very deal specific thing and a very difficult answer otherwise. But yeah, in generally speaking, there's a tax indemnity insurance available in the market which can be explored for certain specific situations.
Mark, if you'd like to add to that, but just one specific question as to, is the insurance coverage very different from the indemnity coverage that we're looking at in such insurance?
there shouldn't be at all. But it's worth pausing to note that when we talk about tax insurance, we're talking about specific tax indemnities. So, you know, the W&I products that we have been talking about include the tax warranties, obviously, but also if there is a general tax deed, tax covenant that covers tax for the period prior to completion, or essentially unknown tax dealing, that's grouped back with the tax warranties. For specific tax issues, exactly as Mandira mentioned, it will depend on looking at the strength of the legal analysis. But if that is something that is robust and what we're doing is providing certainty, then absolutely it's worth discussing a potential insurance solution. One further point on that is that, Nishal, you mentioned advanced tax payments. Any tax insurance policy will respond on the basis that you would have to make the payment to the revenue in order to then challenge it. So we understand that, and we would know if we were structuring a specific tax solution that you will have to receive the power under the policy before the insurer and the insured can together consider whether it's worth mitigating that by then challenging for the revenue.
Extremely, extremely useful. I'd quickly like to thank the panel for their insights on this session. I hope everyone found them as interesting as we hope they were. We'll first open the house for questions from people who dialed in on the phone line. And of course, everyone who's here, we can follow up and continue with questions. But that'll be logical in the interest of time. So I'll request the moderator to kind of pile in the questions now.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and 1 on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to only use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Any participants on the audio bridge, if you wish to ask a question, you may please press star and 1. We have the first question from the line of Adarsh from Samvad Partners. Please go ahead.
Just a question on withholding tax obligation. If there is a structure where a part of the consideration is withheld and parked in an escrow, and say after the escrow period, if the escrow agent has to release the money depending upon how the indemnity claim gets resolved, the escrow agent, is he required to also determine whether any withholding tax should be implemented or not? Is that obligation on him, or is that obligation on the parties who have involved the escrow agent?
So the obligation will be on the purchaser of shares in this situation. Escrow agent is just merely acting in his capacity as custodian for the shares or the cash. And in this situation, the withholding obligation will arise at the time when the share transfer happens, and not when the finality is achieved on whether the escrow amount needs to be released to the seller or the buyer. So under the tax laws, what is important is that the tax gets triggered on the date of transfer of shares and not when the consideration is paid. So let's take a situation where you are transferring 100 shares for $100, but $60 you are paying upfront and $40 you are paying after 12 months. The tax liability on entire $100, so whatever is the capital gain on $100 will get triggered on the date of transfer, irrespective of the fact whether the balance $40 is paid or not at the end of first year.
Okay, understood. Thank you.
Thank you. Any participants who wish to ask a question at this time may please press star and 1.
Guessing, moderator, you don't have any further questions from people on the line. I'm going to open the house for questions here before we are present live. Any questions before we are present here, we're good to hear.
we keep the line running, so people are going to be able to please.
My question is on the tax indemnity insurance. Is it possible to obtain a tax indemnity insurance for a transaction which has already happened 1 year or 2 years back? One. Two, is it insurance based on the SPA? Because you end up selling shares of the same entity to four different purchasers. So do you need to get one insurance for the same asset or four different insurance? And again, what would be the cost for it?
So on the second question, no, you don't need to get four different policies. We can structure a policy with the insurer where in the same policy, you would have all those SPAs covered. They would have an impact on the pricing because depending on what is the gamut of representation that are being made, are they very different to what each one of them are? So that's more of a pricing question, but in terms of a structure, we can have the same policy which can cover. So the policies are transaction specific. In fact, one of the structures that Nishal was talking about was a portfolio sale where there could be a number of assets which are being sold at in one tranche or in several tranches. And we have done policies where different tranches get insured in each policy. So there's one first tranche, if there are seven assets being sold, we can have all the seven assets, all the seven SPAs in the same policy. In fact, when the second tranche happens with the next six assets, for example, then what we can do is we can use the same policy which was used for the first tranche as the base of the second tranche, that there is not, you don't need to duplicate the work and renegotiate the policy. We can use that as a basis and just roll it on further. So in terms of structuring, yes, that is possible. I don't know if you have anything more to add to the structuring part.
On the pricing point, but are you suggesting that if, as a PE fund, Mauritius-based PE fund, I have 10 portfolio companies,
yeah,
I can get one master policy and keep adding whenever I want to sell a particular portfolio company?
No. I think what she's saying is, in case there is a portfolio sale which is happening where you are selling 10 companies together.
Yeah. Okay.
Then in that situation you can.
Just to your question, there's something called the fund wrapper policy is available as well, where what can be done is for the exits that particular fund has made, a particular SPV has made, you might have made a few exits over the past 3 years and they might be unexpired warranties from each of them. There might have been one. And what can be structured is a fund wrapper policy which would have a master policy where all the unexpired warranties can come within that one policy. So that is a separate product, which is to be done, which is at a fund level product, while what I was discussing earlier was a transaction which was happening at a fund level where at the same time, maybe a private equity fund is selling. We've done a real estate deal where there were six projects which were sold by, which was owned by three SPVs, and that entire transaction was structured in one.
And that's right, and that actually where you have the fund wrapper, you can amend that to bring disposals in as they occur. Going back to the first question you raised on pricing, I think you mentioned that specifically in the context of a contingent tax policy. If you take out that policy 2 years after the tax would have crystallized, so say for example capital gains tax, then there'll only be 5 years left of the limitation period. So your policy period will be less. There's no reason why we couldn't ensure that. And in fact, there has been 2 years for the revenue to investigate that. So it would have submitted tax returns in that time. Ultimately, the risk is lower. So yes, we could. And second, it would probably have an impact on pricing and make it cheaper.
As long as in that 2 year period, there hasn't been an adverse event.
Of course, yeah.
In certain situations, what we have done because of the high-speed deal where you have to close the deal, and you know, insurance might take, let's say, a month's time to diligence and, you know, to get comfortable with the opinions and everything. What we have done is we say that we'll put certain amount in escrow for 2-3 months after the deal is signed and closed, and during this 2-3 month period, we'll get the insurance policy. And then replace the escrow amount with the insurance. So once the insurance policy is in place, the escrow amount gets released to the seller.
Just a point, it doesn't always take a month to...
just a remark on that. I think it's just important to note that if an issue is under-reported from revenue, then generally speaking, that's not something that insurance carriers are willing to insure. And likewise, if there's an issue that is currently in active litigation, then again, that really wouldn't
that would be really covered in the insurance. If there's a litigation going on a particular tax situation, that wouldn't get covered in the insurance.
Well, there's no reason why you know, in principle it couldn't, but the appetite of insurers is that they won't.
And sorry, just on the point of how long it takes to get an insurance, and I think that's something which we haven't discussed so far. We placed a policy both on tax and on wanting energy side within a week. That's at the far end of it, which is obviously depending on what the deal dynamics were. I think at that point we needed a policy. It's like I said, it's not advisable. Best is to start the process earlier on. Typically, you would take 3 to 4 weeks to negotiate an SPA. Therefore, a policy can be placed in 2 weeks. I think 2 weeks is an ideal time. We've done it in 1 week as well, but I think one should keep in mind 2 weeks for either of the two policies to have in place so that you have at least a well-negotiated policy. It's a bespoke policy. It's unlike other forms of insurance, like a motor policy where we just go and buy a policy and the wording sum. Here, you actually negotiate, just like an SPA, the entire policy. And there is a front of a policy, which is to do with the terms and conditions. And then there's a back of the policy, which actually has the entire warranty spreadsheet, which is going to be there. And they actually list out the warranties and put a comment against them, cover, excluded cover. So that entire process, it's the same. The pricing is not going to come down. So it's going to be the benefit of the client to make sure there is sufficient time to negotiate those warranties so that you get maximum cover for the
Is there
for
an indicative pricing here?
Yes, so my experience based on across-the-board transactions we've done, obviously depends a lot on the industry, depends on, what is the limit that is being bought, what is the limit as a percentage of the enterprise value, who are the parties involved, is it a private equity fund, is it a corporate, there are various factors.
Tax indemnity, I'm saying.
Oh, but for tax indemnity, it's a lot more expensive than a warranty indemnity insurance. I think 7 to 9%, which is again a one-time premium at the start of the policy, but that's typically where we've seen the market.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, everyone. We can continue chatting for people who are here, but we'll call the conference to a close now. Thank you, everyone, for attending.
You may want to announce about the cocktails.
Yeah, I thought I'll do it after the phone. The phone line is shut.
That's okay.
Of course, as you said, for all of us, all of you would like to join us downstairs at Lima for on the property. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.